The Guardian.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen, sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar.
Hello, I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian. This month's book club choice is Alan Hollinghurst's Man Booker Prize winner The Line of Beauty, which brought a gay sensibility to the class politics of Thatcherite Britain. Its protagonist is an awkward student who befriends the son of an upper-class family. John Mullen was especially pleased to welcome Hollinghurst to talk about his novel because that student, Nick Guest, is doing a PhD at Mullen's own Department of English at University College London. In fact, as Mullen revealed, he's made it a set text on the course there and has found his students have a wide range of opinions about Guest.
I think I never know what people are going to say or how they're going to react, and I actually love the fact that readers react in such different and very strongly personal ways to characters in a novel. It's a different thing from actually writing a novel in the first person, which my first two novels were, where you're totally sort of locked into seeing everything through, you can't escape from the mind of this person. I think in a third person novel, though everything, as you say, is filtered through Nick's, everything's seen from his point of view. I mean, he is also seen from the outside by me, the controlling novelist, so you have the privilege of observing him from the outside and visiting his thoughts when you want to. I suppose they're rather like relationships in life, aren't they? I think that the reader enters into this new relationship, beginning the book, and you're constantly trying to work out what you think of the person. I hope that there's a great deal of uncertainty and ambivalence in that relationship. I've certainly had very widely differing reactions, as you say, from people who, I mean, someone said a woman said to me that she thought he was adorable and she would have done, you know, just as he had in this, allowing for various changes. Another a close friend of mine just said that he detested Nick instinctively from the very first page, right, which I thought was a little too soon.
Yes.
But I love the fact that the sort of medium of the book can have that element of sort of ambivalence in it, yeah.
There were one or two bits later on, indeed, quite late in the book, where you seemed to me almost to have inserted things which seemed almost inserted to make you a bit irked by him. There was a moment when the narrative says something like, Nick wasn't sure what this was, but it was something that seemed to be making lots of people money, and he thought might even make him some money. It would be a very sympathetic reader who didn't think you complacent, irritating, you know.
No, I mean, there are things where Nick does things sort of more reprehensible than that. I mean, I've just reread the book, oddly sort of not from beginning to end, but in a sort of rather postmodern way of reading chapters in a sort of jumbled order. Some of it I hadn't read for sort of 6 years, and I'd rather forgotten about. But the scene towards the end where Nick remembers his last sighting of Leo,
yes, yes.
And Leo's sister has come to him and told him that Leo's died, and he says, do you remember the last time you saw him? And he comes up with a time which actually had turned out to be the last time that they'd met in the sort of crowd in Oxford Street, and Leo going off on his bike, and Nick not knowing it was the last time. But then he says, actually, there was this time earlier in the present year when he'd gone into a pub and seen him there and realised that he was ill, and he was too cowardly, yes, to face up to seeing him. I was terribly shocked by that, yes, reading it again. I mean, he calls himself a coward.
Yes.
He says he knew he was too cowardly to face up to the challenge of this,
yes,
moment.
I didn't really notice it till the sort of second or third time I read the novel, but which, as a devotee of Jane Austen, I especially liked about him, which is missing from lots of protagonists of novels, which is he blushes quite a lot.
Yes.
But seriously, I think that's one of the things that makes him, one of the things that does make him sympathetic. And on a couple of occasions, he even blushes for somebody else who doesn't blush themselves.
Exactly.
For their stupidity, yes, or crassness.
Yes. The blush is, yes, is a sign of the naming of something that the person wants to keep secret.
Yes.
So it's bound to happen rather a lot.
But it's a real kind of way of getting a reader into the inwardness, I think, sometimes, of somebody. The thing I wanted to ask you about was a word which is in the title of the first of the three sections of the novel, and a word that Nick, in his thoughts at least, seems to use quite a lot, which is love. that word doesn't seem to be strained too much by his relationship with Leo, and he's all in a kind of dazzle about that. But he carries on thinking about or thinking of himself as somebody who loves others, and particularly in his relationship with Wani, whom, as he explicitly recognises, never uses that word.
Well, people can be in love with people who aren't deserving of it, of course. I mean, when my first book came out, a reviewer in The Spectator saying that the word love was absurdly used for these relationships between men, which really couldn't be dignified by this noble old term. And actually, I think I've always been rather interested in the sort of varieties of love and the importance to people of feeling sensations which they call love, which may not be the same as the ones that other people call love. Of course, to other people in the book, looking on, they see that one is, a selfish little shit, and they can't understand why someone would be in love with him. Well, Catherine particularly can't.
I mean, it reminded me, I suppose, a little bit of the way that characters in Restoration comedies usually talk of love for the passions that drive them, and often those passions, if you're a cynical viewer, seem a little more base than what we like to think of as love, but they insistently say it's love.
Well, I think Nick has an idealising, sort of strongly idealising strain in him, so he's likely to interpret anything as something higher and nobler than it is.
And it's a kind of historical novel. I mean, it was an historical novel when it's published, which is becoming in a way more historical. I wanted to ask you about the structure of it, and the structure of it, these three sections have titles, but they also have dates.
83, yes, I mean, it was a couple of years after I moved to London myself, but I think I felt that I could still access that mood of a young person sort of moving to, I wasn't quite as young as Nick is in the book, but that I knew that world of 1983, really before things changed. You know, there had been this terrible slump at the beginning of the Thatcher period. Then, between that and the next election, there was a staggering boom. So 86 seemed to me a good point to sort of show that at its sort of apogee. And then the 87 election coming afterwards. I knew I wanted it to be, as it were, in episodes with gaps in between them, and it's obviously something I've become much more interested in my more recent, my latest book. But just to show up those sort of startlements and ironies of the passage of time, and leaving Nick at just beginning on this big affair at the end of the first part, and then plunging the reader into a quite new situation where he's in the midst of an affair with someone completely different, who in the first part had seemed entirely
unattainable.
So the unattainable becomes attainable, as it was obviously the sort of idea in the second part. And is it, be careful what you wish for, as it were. I remember enjoying that, making that jump.
I mean, the gaps, I was going to ask you about the gaps. The second page, as it is in this edition, of this section. George has gone then. Steve just told me he went last night. By assuming that by gone the old boy didn't mean gone on holiday, and it's happened in that gap.
That's
presumably
right.
That's an historical.
Yes, no, that was absolutely. 83. I think we sort of knew about AIDS as something mysterious and terrible, which was happening in America principally, and of course I remember it being written about in that. Particularly the latter part of that year, but it seemed inconceivable that it could ever sort of come to come here. Then 84, I think, was when it really began to make its mark in this country, and there was a huge change over those years. So in a way, this sort of idealised, in Nick's own mind, idealised world that he's entering, this image of gay life as sort of swimmers sitting on a sunlit bank, was going to be very severely challenged. And I suppose it's one of the many things which makes Wani himself so sort of cautious and circumspect and paranoid about his own homosexuality.
That's one example of what sort of happens in the gap between the first section and the second. I suppose the the main thing that happens. There are lots of intriguing little things you have to puzzle out as you go along. But the main thing that happens is a transformation of the central character, the protagonist of the novel, from an innocent to somebody who at least fancies himself rather sophisticated, yep. And certainly knowing in the ways of being a kind of gay young man in London. I mean, you've got this gap and you have to sort of fill in what you think has happened, including in very sort of some plot ways. Where's Leo gone? Yep. You know, as an old-fashioned reader, I remember first time I read it thinking, what's happened to Leo? Where, and, you know, and you do find out, of course, but it takes quite a long time. I mean, why did you want to do that with...
I suppose in that case it was something to do with Nick's sort of avoiding the truth of what had happened. You know, he didn't understand why they'd broken up. He wasn't sort of facing up to what might have happened to Leo subsequently. I think I just thought, and if I had written all the, done all the building in between, the book would have been about 3,000 pages long. One has the divine little principle of selection, as Henry James calls it, has to.
But you do like, you'd quite like even ending the individual chapters on, cliffhangers is too crude a word, but on little preludes to emotional storms which must take place, but you then move on to another, the wonderful moment where Catherine and Nick discover Gerald in his, I won't say what Barry Groom calls it, but in his flat where he's meeting Penny, and there he is half undressed smoking a cigarette, and she says, "Dad, I thought you'd given up smoking," and that's the end of it. And of course, if you're a TV dramatist, I imagine that would be the beginning of it. You know, you'd be so tempted to fill in. I mean,
that's very true. Yes, I'm struck by that. Indeed, when this was televised, the demands of narrative structure in film are very different from those in the novel. And I actually love that thing of sort of suspension and leaving the reader wondering and having to puzzle out for themselves, avoiding the obvious in a way.
I was thinking about something I noticed as well in your most recent novel. You quite like structuring the novel by using sort of set-piece events, I suppose. I mean, there are other novels. Anthony Pohl does this. People remember lots of things about the Line of Beauty, but they often remember the parties, the dinner parties, the concert. Is that particularly appealing to you as a way of working?
I think I always have like writing parties, but yes, again, it's something to do with the way that the book is, partly to do with the way the book is written. It's a sort of what Henry James called the occasion. You know, if everything is being seen through the consciousness of one person, then you have to create occasions which will bring things to, he has to have this central consciousness has to have access to the material, and so a social gathering is a wonderful way of sort of bringing all these things sort of into his sphere of observation. The other, of course, was just a more social point that amongst these rich and getting much richer people in the ages, the idea of the heavily catered party and lots of staff and so on seemed to me sort of ideally sort of typical of how these people were living their lives, and they were showing off to each other. And the whole gag about the concert, of course, is the other people having much more ambitious concerts, and Michael Heseltine's actually hired the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra rather than this sort of young Czech pianist that no one's ever heard of.
Yeah. Nina something over.
Nina something over, yeah.
The one that really interests me is Gerald's wife, Rachel. Partly because she seems rather to interest Nick, or he, whenever she is described from his point of view, it's almost always with some sense that there are unstated ironies or implications in what she says, which are never kind of going to, which she's always too subtle to make apparent, that she's capable of these infinitely tactful. I mean, she is out of a Henry James novel, or he seems to think that she is. And then right at the end, he has a conversation with her in which she says a series of sort of really pretty horrid things to him, which to each of which he sort of responds, "Oh," he's quite pained. And he says to Penny, doesn't he, "Oh, Rachel's a special friend of mine. And Penny says, I wonder if she feels the same way about you. I mean, I found her fascinating as a character, and as I sort of found myself wondering at that stage, right at the end, whether her sort of subtlety and irony and grace and everything had indeed all been almost an invention, a fascinating invention of the protagonist. Mm. Am I right?
I think that's a strong element of that, yes. I mean, she hardly sort of exists in a way, except yes. as an emanation of his ideal of what such a person should be. And I suppose he sees in her a sort of super ironical and sophisticated ally against the sort of rather crude, obvious humour and self-evident motives of Gerald. In her, everything is sort of subtly yes. concealed and merely hinted at. And I think in his sort of insecurity, he sees her as embodying some ideal of sort of sophisticated conduct, which he wishes he could emulate. But actually, she is, as we were saying, mysteriously, sort of inalienably, sort of devoted to this man that she's married to and had two children by, and that's a sort of mystery which actually Nick can't comprehend.
Yeah, I mean, she's the richest of the lot, isn't
exactly,
she?
Yeah,
and that's sort of it seems to be a sort of tempting to read that as his self-fulfilling wish that it be possible to be gifted with the loot, but also the fine sensibility.
Well, that's the sort of Jamesian yes. ideal, I suppose, isn't it? Yes, that you don't have to worry about where the money is coming from. You can just sort of live at this level of refined suggestion.
Whereas at least in a way, again, with Gerald in paradoxically likeable way, he isn't. He doesn't understand what a painting is or... he doesn't even know what it's called or the right. He just wants it as a show-off thing, doesn't he? And in a peculiar way, that ends up being a kind of brutally kind of transparent and therefore human.
Yes. I mean, I'm not at all interested in creating caricatures, really, and I don't think of the book as it was described a certain amount when it came out as being a satire on sort of
yes.
I mean, I didn't think of it. I mean, there are some of the minor characters, perhaps, are they are little sort of satirical cameos, but I certainly didn't see Gerald as being a satirical. I mean, I'm interested in creating sort of quite complicated human beings, and there are obviously things which are terribly nice about him. He's sort of quite generous, open-hearted, yes. quite amusing, good guy. As we were saying, he obviously has some tremendous sort of animal appeal as well, which Nick occasionally senses himself as rather disturbed by at the yes. beginning when they've got back from France.
Yes.
His bum has got very sort of firm with all the tennis and swimming, and yeah. Nick's rather disturbed to find himself sort of quite fancying Gerald's rear view. I hope he's not easily. I mean, there are the two. There's the thing with his mania for embracing and absorbing criticism by buying caricatures that are made of him. So they hang in the kitchen and guests who happen to be in the
yes,
kitchen at the same
yes,
time
yes,
sort of
yeah.
compare.
Yeah, and he can't
himself.
Wait for a spitting image. Yeah, puppet,
that's right. That's, I think,
yeah.
he really, the supreme accolade. But people look at this sort of caricature image and at the same time, alongside him, and it leaves you with an uncertainty as to which is the real Gerald, I suppose.
So you weren't, as people said, of course, in reviews, sort of attempting to anatomise Thatcherism or anything like that. Did you know from early on she was going to make that appearance?
Yes, I did, yes. And that was always part of the design. And sort of the part of the book I remember enjoying writing the most. I certainly didn't want to do anything as systematic as anatomising Thatcher's Britain. I mean, that doesn't seem to me really the job of a novel, or certainly not of a novel which I would be likely to write. I'm much more interested in tracing the sort of peculiar trajectory of a rather peculiar individual sort of through a world and letting it sort of impact on him and letting his experience reflect things that were going on at the time. But I didn't want something which was very thematically sort of obvious in that way. I mean, there's the grotesque scene after his dance with Mrs. Thatcher when they're upstairs in the bathroom with the waiter and everything, you know, which is just a horrible sort of expose of ideas of getting anything you want for money, you know, utter self-indulgence, actually just bordering on hellish misery. So.
And of course, endings are often, I think, what readers, where the focus comes, of people's sort of enthusiasms, disagreements, how the book has ended. And you've chosen, I suppose, I don't know, is it in Jamesian fashion, he being renowned for being the kind of great novelist who really made an art of the indeterminate ending? Was indeterminacy an important part of the design of it from the beginning?
Well, I think I tend to do that. There's quite a lot of sort of plot resolution just before the end, and then I have a kind of coda which sort of is a way of ushering the reader out of the book into the continuing world of uncertainties and indeterminacies. Yes, it's a sort of compounded expulsion, I suppose, at the end, isn't it? He's rejected from the house. And in the light of that moment and in the street and everything, he sort of thinks, well, actually, I'm going to be expelled from my life, from the world.
It's past time, probably, when I should give everybody here a chance to ask Alan questions.
Well, first of all, can I say that I really love this book. I've read it three times. I've never read a contemporary novel three times.
Oh, I'm very excited.
I think it completely captures the spirit of the 80s in a way no other novel I've ever read. Can you explain the title? Because I have tried very hard to divine the line of beauty within the book, and I'm not sure I understood it.
The title, I hope it has sort of multiple meanings. It sort of clicked with me, and I felt that it was right at various levels, from the physical one of, you know, we see Nick looking at Wani lying face down in bed, and his sort of insuperably aestheticizing way, he sort of says how the shape of Wani's lower back and bottom sort of traces the line of beauty. And Wani himself, of course, makes the joke about lines of coke being lines of beauty, a sort of slightly more phantasmagoric, unreliable kind of beauty. But I think I thought of Nick himself as being someone who sort of follows the line of beauty through life, you know, that, I mean, rather than, as it were, the line of duty, or someone who will always be sort of tempted to follow where beauty leads rather than other things, and perhaps make some very foolish decisions as a result.
You said that you find each book increasingly difficult to write, having just read The Stranger's Child, which I thoroughly loved.
Yes, it's annoying, you know. I think I thought when I started that you would sort of work out how to write a book, and then you sort of carried on doing it, and it got easier and easier. And I suspect there are some novelists of whom that's true. I suppose it's something to do with sort of setting myself more difficult tasks, sort of technically and in terms of what I'm trying to do generally, and sort of fear of repeating myself, and also just getting older and perhaps not having quite as much sort of imaginative pep as I used to. But it does become, I mean, I remember writing my first book, but was a very, very happy experience, and I think it was something I was doing. I had a full-time job, it's something I did in the evenings and at weekends, and it was just, I had the secret place I went to and no one knew anything about it or had any expectation of it, and there was a sort of innocence about the whole thing, which I don't suppose anybody can quite recapture that when writing later things.
We've heard quite a lot about what your students think of Nick and what the critics think of Nick, but we've also heard about this sort of double expulsion at the end of the book. And 6 years on, 7 years on, what do you think of Nick? What did you think of him when you wrote it?
It's probably the most ambivalent one of all. I had a very complex relationship with him, as I think I have had with other sort of protagonists in books I've written. You know, I entrust a huge amount to him, and he has to be the person who's reacting and observing, and I'm quite invested in him in a way, but I'm also doing this thing of these things of making him, you know, behave very badly on occasion. But the first part of the book, I did sort of think I had to plunge into my own memories of what it was like to sort of go on a first date and to answer an ad and that kind of thing. And I thought the only way to do this, to make this work, would just be to be as sort of truthful as possible about, I'm not saying that it's as autobiographical, but to sort of talk about what the insecurities and fears of a young person might be. So I think in the first part of the book I felt closest to him. I felt each section of the book has a sort of different atmosphere and is almost in a different sort of genre. You know, the first book is, I thought of as a kind of romance, and the second part as a sort of farce, and the last part as sort of moving into tragedy. As a consequence, I had very sort of shifting relationship with him, I think. But I had to maintain a degree of sort of belief in him as a nice person. It's rather hard to describe now, but not a simple relationship anyway.
Gentleman here.
I'm a psychotherapist, and I'm absolutely astonished at the amazing understanding you have of human emotions in A Line of Beauty. Oh. I was very touched, and I enjoyed, and I have to ask the obvious question, have you studied psychology?
Not as such, no. I read Kay Jameson's book about being a manic depressive and so on, not actually as research, but just because I was interested in it, and having had a couple of friends who developed manic depression, I got sort of, I was very sort of fascinated by that. And I hope that it didn't seem too much just like a sort of narrative tool, that I wasn't sort of exploiting Catherine's manic depression as a sort of plot device. But I have no sort of academic knowledge of psychiatry at all.
You talk quite a bit about how Henry James influenced you. I was wondering if you got any influence from Brideshead Revisited, because that's what it really reminded me of.
I'm a bit sort of saddled with Brideshead, which people keep bringing up. Of course, the idea of someone who's sort of glamorized by a family that they sort of become a part of. My sort of early idea that it would be interesting to write about the long-term guest, you know, the person who comes to stay for a few weeks and then ends up staying for years, and the person who is that interestingly ambiguous status of the person who's partly a parasite but also actually sort of helps the whole machinery run, and so in a way becomes indispensable to the host. I mean, that I think it's quite an interesting sort of situation, not very much written about, and it has its parallel in the Brideshead idea, obviously. When the book came out in the States, one of the reviews there said it was a simple transposition of Brideshead with Roman Catholicism replaced by Thatcherism. But of course, I mean, that obviously doesn't work, because Roman Catholicism remains absolutely unchallenged as a sort of supreme thing at the end of Brideshead, whereas I hope by the end of this book the tenets of Thatcherism have been subjected to some pretty damaging examination.
Thanks. I think we're going to allow Alan that Chardonnay, if that's what it is. And we will re-emerge, or Alan will re-emerge, to sign the book, so just be a little bit patient. And I just wanted to thank you all for coming and thank him very much.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen is sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar. Cornish cheddars made with over 60 years of knowledge, time and skill. To find out more, please visit davidstowecheddar.co.uk.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.